break down those barriers, those institutional barriers, like that school lunch program.
Yeah.
Like those summer feeding programs where we can
Didn't you spearhead an effort to make sure that food stamps could be used at farmers markets, which I think is
a no-brainer.
Awesome. Yeah.
Now,
because that's the good food.
If you're on government assistance, then we should try to make sure you're eating healthy,
right? Not getting empty calories. I can't imagine.
I see somebody
with exception of maybe celery. I can't imagine anything at a farmer's market that's just empty calories.
No.
So in a lot of our farmers markets now, they can take EBD cards.
Welcome to the Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
All right, welcome back to the Disruption Zone. I am Leland Conway along with Cameron Mills. What's going on, dude?
Hey, everybody. Hang on, let me try that again. Let me not mumble into the microphone.
What was that word you just said?
Hello, buddy.
Oh, okay, there we go. Because you've been trying to speak Latin this morning. We got a very special guest here. I think, and he'll tell me if I'm right on this, but I think he is the youngest statewide elected politician in America. Is that right, Ryan Quarles?
Despite my gray hair, that's what I've been told.
He is 34. He is our state agriculture commissioner. And by the way, welcome to the program. How are you?
Yeah, glad to be here.
We have to settle an argument that we had out in the lobby, though.
Oh.
Because I guess you are technically a millennial. Technically, so we were arguing what makes a millennial.
He's far too mature.
Far too mature
he's
to be.
Far, I mean, that's it's plus, impossible given what he does for a living.
Plus, here's the thing. We're recording this episode prior, we had to be here like before 9 o'clock this morning, and that was your fault, Ryan Quarles.
Yeah,
I haven't seen the early side of 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning in like years. You're getting up too early. You're not lazy enough to be a millennial.
If you want to fix that, we have about 30 acres of tobacco that needs some attention on the back 40 of our farm. So come on out.
It may be his fault, but he's a farmer at heart. They get up at like 3 a.m. anyway, right?
Yeah, what is the latest you've ever slept in as a farmer?
Oh, I can sleep in. It just depends on what needs to be done that day. But you want to talk about...
Wait a minute. Is there ever a day that on a farm something doesn't need to be done?
Oh, there's something that has to be done every single day. And if not, my dad would make something up just to make sure I don't get rusty.
Do you ever get up, milk the pigs? I'm sorry, the cows. Milk the cows and then go back to bed? Do you ever do that?
No, we've never had that, but I will tell you this. You want to meet people who can wake up in the morning, just go talk to a dairy farmer. Those guys wake up at 4 and 3 every single day. And, you know, I think I have a bad day working in tobacco. Those dairy folks, every single day, no vacation.
Wait a minute. Before we go any further, did you mean, was that a joke? The milk the pigs?
Yeah, I was just joking. Okay. I'm not that stupid.
Are you sure?
I like my sister.
Because you looked at me like, wow, I can't believe I said that. And I really want this to have been an accident.
My sister, it was on purpose. But my sister dated a guy in college who was from Newark, New Jersey. And, of course, we lived in Arizona. We grew up open range. Cows were everywhere. Yep. He flew out to visit one time, and he couldn't tell. I swear to God, he couldn't tell the difference between a cow and a horse. And we had them all over the reservation. He didn't know which one was which. I swear to God. New York, New Jersey, right there. That would seem like that would take maybe
one introduction to each animal, and then you're good.
The bigger one is the horse, most of the time.
I don't know. I've been to the state fair. There's some big cows out there, too.
Big pigs, too. Yeah. So, anyway, we want to bring in your agriculture commissioner for the state of Kentucky. And what's interesting is there's some things I think a lot of people don't know about Kentucky on the agricultural front that kind of puts us at the forefront. But you're an actual farmer politician. Like that, you actually, I remember you ran against a guy with the last name of Farmer. I think it was. And he tried to take advantage of that. But you were the only one that was like an actual farmer.
Well, yeah, I think my predecessor ran against a guy named Bob Farmer.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, okay, it was Jamie Comer did that.
You know, for me, I grew up on a farm. I'm ninth generation Central Kentucky, living, working. I'm not out there every day. I'm going to be really clear about that. I'm just too busy. But I help out when dad's in a tough spot or whatnot. But it's so important that with this office, it's so weird. We elect an ag commissioner. And most people, when I'm out campaigning or meeting people, they say, first off, what's an ag commissioner and why do I have to vote for it?
Yeah, what do you do?
And so it's just such a weird office. But in Kentucky, It is part of our identity. It's part of our heritage. It's part of our roots. And you don't have to go very far. Even in the most densely populated areas of this state, you can find agriculture everywhere. And that's something that makes my office pretty cool.
Well, some of it's illegal, I'm just saying. I've heard about that.
Yeah.
Every part of our state.
A lot of it in the hills of southeastern Kentucky.
Yeah, just saying.
Yeah. That's why those ATVs are so important.
But speaking of which, that brings us, because for a long time, Kentucky was steadfastly against introducing a crop that used to grow here naturally or to be a big crop or a big export crop for Kentucky, and that was hemp, because a lot of people didn't know the difference between hemp and marijuana, and they're cousins, but they're not the same. You can't smoke hemp and get high. And
right.
I don't even think you can grow the two together, can you?
You can smoke anything, let's be clear. It may not get you what you want, I could smoke the styrofoam cup if I wanted to.
Yeah, try it.
Wouldn't recommend it. I'm just saying I could.
Have you ever drank a cup of coffee that was so hot that the styrofoam melted and tasted melted styrofoam?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. That's not healthy.
That's a Cosmo Kramer issue right there, hot coffee.
Seriously.
Yeah, so hemp. So it's a crop that connects Kentucky's past to our future. My great-grandfather grew it just like most farmers did. It was just part of a diversified farming operation, and the U.S. Navy needed rope, and so we grew it. Henry Clay was one of the largest hemp growers in Kentucky. In year 1900, 75% of all the hemp grown in the country came from central Kentucky. We have the history. We're bringing it back, and I'm so excited that just this week, just recently, legalization of industrial hemp made it into the U.S. Senate version of the Farm Bill. So we're so excited.
It's going to pass it because that's going to take it off that, what do you call
controlled
that?
Substance
controlled
Act.
Substance
And list, that's
right?
Exactly what needs to happen. The biggest impediment to hemp right now, to the growth of hemp, is it being on the Controlled Substance Act. And guess what? This is one of the few areas of bipartisanship we're seeing out of D.C. right now. McConnell, Rand Paul, Chuck Schumer all support this.
Wow.
Big.
Wow.
Very big.
Okay, let's back up for the ignorant in the room. Why is it on? I understand it's similar to the cannabis plant, right?
Sure.
The marijuana plant.
Sure.
I think it looks close.
But it's not. I understand. Yes, that's the part that I always understood.
But I have
the
some
reason
weeds
it was
that
illegal.
Look like it too.
The reason it was illegal was because the officers, those who needed to destroy the marijuana, it was hard to tell the difference quickly.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. Now, there's some varieties of industrial hemp, say like the fiber variety that grows straight and tall and go up to 14, 15 feet. There's a clear visual difference between that and its illicit cousin. But there's also folks that back in the 70s actually pushed for industrial hemp to become illegal, mainly those who made ropes as well. There's a lot of conspiracies out there that you want to get rid of a natural competitor. But I think we're at the turning point. Kentucky has been the tip of the spear on researching this, tip of the spear on making products that people want to buy. You know, last year, 2017 alone, we sold almost $17 million of Kentucky-grown industrial hemp products, ranging from fiber to CBD oil. This is a market-based approach, research program. And guess what? This isn't just university-led. These are consumers out there choosing with their pocketbooks what they want to buy, and it's being successful.
Can you grow marijuana in a hemp field? I've always heard you can't.
Well, if you do, it's on a cross-pollinate, and it's going to, from my understanding, what I've been told, it's going to ruin marijuana. And so that pollen moves. I've seen hemp pollen above a field. It can get up, move around. And so the best thing about industrial hemp is that it is a crop that we believe would actually help eradicate marijuana in the state. Now, a lot of that's anecdotal. I'll be the first one to tell you that.
Right, but let's say you're in an eastern Kentucky county where you have a big problem with it, and you have eight or nine large licensed operations. That pollen gets in the air, and it might destroy the illicit one on the next holler over.
That's right. That's right. And of course, our program, we pride ourselves on the fact that that almost all the hemp that's grown is compliant. It has very de minimis amount of THC in it. We're doing what other industrialized countries have been doing for decades. Yeah. We're doing it in a responsible way. And that's one reason why I think Senator McConnell and the U.S. Senate are getting behind this, because they're not looking at it as a crop that you confuse with marijuana. They're looking at it as a crop for economic development and one that has a lot of potential here in Kentucky.
They're moving forward. I mean, it's simply stated. I mean, they're looking at an opportunity to move something forward and say, let's get out of the past.
That's right. You know, just last week, I helped cut the ribbon on a hemp company that just celebrated hiring their 60th person full time, making payroll, paying taxes, and making a product that people want. And that's what, you know, Kentucky's usually last a lot of things. This is an opportunity for us to be first.
Yeah. Well, let's explain something, Ryan. What because it's illegal, but yet it can be grown in the state of Kentucky legally right now under certain circumstances.
A very narrow research exemption from the last farm bill back in 2014, successfully lobbied in by Congressman Massey, Senator Paul, and Senator McConnell, were able to get that in. And because of that small exemption, we have a market-based research program that is unlike any other state. We're the biggest. And it's time for us to just completely get rid of the exemption, open it up, have a few minimal controls, and let this crop reach its full potential, because there will be a massive amount of investment coming to Kentucky once it's legalized.
I think it's important, too, to give some context on like how far we've come, because a shameless plug for my other show, News Radio 840 WHS. Go ahead and plug
yours. Oh, can I do mine too? Yeah, Cameron Mills Radio, Sunday night, 7 to 9, perfect. On right. Many stations all over.
But your predecessor, James Comer, yep. I actually asked him one time. I was like, because he was also fighting for this issue. And, yep. And he said, I asked him, I said, are you willing to get arrested by federal agents to stand with a Kentucky farmer who you have permitted to grow hemp? And he said yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you said the same thing to me when you first got elected. Although
absolutely.
it was not, there was no danger of that at that point. But I was trying to make.
So his answer really doesn't matter.
No, that's not what I'm saying. You worked with Comer. I mean, I'm pointing out how far we've come on this. That now you're sitting here talking about, look at all this innovation we're about to explode on the scene with. When, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago.
Not that long ago.
We were still talking about a federally banned product.
You know, a few years ago, I think a lot of people viewed this as a novelty crop, as something that had a lot of curiosity about it. But today, go visit one of these hemp companies, go visit a hemp farmer. The sophistication level is up. The education of the public has been great. I think people see this as an agronomic crop that can compete with corn and soybeans. And there's a lot of people who have helped out with this effort. Farmers have been advocating for this for years. Commissioner Comer, now Congressman Comer, great champion for industrial hemp. We've got friends in Washington, D.C. in the right places right now. And so a lot of people deserve a lot of credit. But what makes Kentucky unique is that we have the heritage, we have the history of this crop, and we have farmers that used to grow tobacco with not a lot of land who are willing and used to trying something different. That's the reason why we're the largest chia farm in Kentucky. It's the reason why you got people.
Hang on.
Chia pets? Chia, yes.
Wait a minute. I thought that was its own farm. That's the whole point. It comes in a little pot and you grow it.
Right.
Why does it need to have
the pot has to be made somewhere.
Oh, is that what it is? Wait a minute. Is that agriculture?
I want a Trump chia pet.
They are there.
I got to have a serious explanation on this. What is chia? Why are we growing it?
Chia, it's like a superfood. Like that's what we're marketing it as.
Chia seeds.
Okay. Chia seeds, just like sesame seeds. People are putting it on their salads.
It's really expensive.
A lot of it comes from South America.
There may not be much of it.
I put them in the smoothies.
So we're going to go to Whole Foods right after this is over, and
we're going to buy some chia seeds.
We're going to make super smoothies. Yeah. Well, you're going to teach
me. What's going to be awesome is you're going to grow the rest of your hair back.
Oh, that'd be great. That would be perfect. If that works, really, I mean, we'll talk a major investment.
Just be sure to mist your head every once in a while. Keep it well watered.
That would be nice.
he's gonna kill me.
No, he's not. He's hoping you're right. He's really where we are.
That's awesome.
He's sitting here thinking about the possibilities. Personal, investment wise.
That's going to be awesome. I'm trying to imagine you in
one of those
bobbleheads.
Forget the bobbleheads.
Seriously. Yeah, exactly.
That's right. That's right.
Let's talk a little bit about innovation because you're a young guy. I mean, at 34, youngest statewide elected politician. When you walked into this, and I know you've got your doctorate from Vanderbilt, which apparently that was a top secret mission. What was the deal with that? Trying to keep that all quiet.
I'm a University of Kentucky Wildcat.
He didn't want anybody to know.
It was SEC affiliation.
That was
the problem.
It was a Commodore thing. Yeah. He didn't want getting out. That's
Candy
what it was.
As we call him.
That's all right. Well, I mean, Senator Rand Paul went to Duke. Right?
Oh, well, so
someone,
did.
The silence right. in here?
Someone has to.
Is there the silence in here?
I can feel the tension. You know,
I
still hate Layton.
An elite private institution
like
that. Speaking
of which, as ag commissioner.
And by the way, when I say elite, I mean elitism, not elite.
Oh, I saw someone with a Kentucky plate yesterday that said D-U-K B-L-U.
What?
D-U-K B-L-U. Duke Blue.
Oh,
on their personalized license plate.
Oh,
I wanted to see if we could call it an error. I wanted to see if we could call it an error.
That's something I feel like you could help with. I mean, like getting that.
That's what I was saying. I wanted to call it an airstrike.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. not to completely derail this conversation on the athletics. I don't hate Duke. I really don't.
Speak for yourself.
Here's what's funny. And this, honestly, now I'm mad. This offends me. Now I'm mad. I get why we hated Duke in 1992 through 1997.
But then in
1998, we rectified the whole situation. And what everyone forgets is we beat him in 78 for the championship, too.
Okay.
Why do we care?
Because the media won't let us forget about that stupid shot.
You're the media right now that's not letting us forget.
Exactly, but I'm going the other way with it. I'm trying to provide balance.
So here's let me explain how we do this.
Ryan's you guys want to talk to me or
we're moving. This is what we do. We're disrupting another conversation.
We're disrupting our own interview.
Yeah. So no, who cares? Look, we're not on their radar. North Carolina's on their radar. Why should they be on our radar?
Anybody who tries to challenge our dominance.
But they don't.
At UK.
We've got eight. They've got five.
Right, but you have to.
They're not even close.
You have to. And how many does North Carolina have?
I think they got five, too.
They shouldn't have. They shouldn't have any compared to the whole academic fraud.
You know what we should be worried about? That's another story, and I'll argue that, too.
Yeah.
UCLA should be what we're concerned about with their 11.
Yeah,
that's what I want to get past.
This is a good
point. I'm not worried about who's behind us.
I agree with you on that.
I'm worried about who's in front of us with national championships.
Good point. All right. Now, innovation.
You can't spell Duke without UK.
I've heard that. I've seen that.
End of discussion. Yeah. End of discussion. We're good on that.
Someone needs to make a shirt like that out of him.
there we go.
Yeah. It would sell.
I want to talk about the food chain because you kind of get to see how this whole process works. I mean, Kentucky is the fifth. Did you know this, Cameron?
I'm going to tell you right now, no. I promise I didn't.
Oh, you're about to. Kentucky's the fifth largest. Am I getting this right? Beef cattle producer east.
We are the first. We're number one. We're the biggest beef cattle state east Mississippi River.
Okay, and then in the country, we're fifth or eighth.
We're eighth nationally.
That's a lot of beef.
A lot of cattle. And one thing we're doing right now is that...
Which is good, because I've had a lot recently.
Yeah, no kidding.
I'll tell you something else you can go ahead and say no, you didn't know about.
Well, he didn't know what he was saying.
Yeah, I just made it up as I was going. Just throw a number out there, he'll correct it.
Cameron, did you know this? We were number five east of the Mississippi, and you corrected by the commission.
Wait, no, I'm not.
No, we're number one.
The average distance food travels from the farm gate to your dinner plate is 1,500 miles.
Mm.
The average.
Jeez. Wow.
And the cattle industry is set up that way. You know, we're huge with breeding and backgrounding and sending them to other farms to get some weight on them. But guess what? They're all sent to the Midwest to be fattened up and finished out. That's the mileage we're talking about. And then they're sent back, and you don't know what you're getting back.
Right.
We decided to disrupt.
Because they get mixed into the system once they get out there.
That's right.
So we might get a...
So the goal was...
A Nevada cattle.
And I want you to finish that sentence because I like where you're going with that. But the goal was we to send them out there and to get ours back, but you're saying we can't do that or we weren't doing that.
Into it.
We were getting whatevers. We're getting New Mexico.
It's an economy scale issue. Yeah. You don't know. But what's cool is that we have a consumer that cares. Consumers are more conscientious about where their food comes from. That's why these farmers markets are flourishing across the state. People love local agriculture, and they're willing to pay a premium for it too. But we have a consumer that just cares about the quality, the standards on a farm. So we decided to disrupt that business model and keep those cattle in Kentucky, finish them out here, process them in eastern Kentucky at the Chop Shop, and now in 85 Kroger stores – you can buy 100% Kentucky Proud beef. This is a big deal.
Cool, here's the thing. We have a group of people who are proud of this state.
Mm-hmm.
So when you put Kentucky Proud on something, I'm buying that.
You're right.
They're buying that over something else.
That's one of the most
politically, not even agriculturally, politically, mm-hmm. that's one of the smartest things I think we've ever done in our state.
It's the best marketing program we've ever had.
It's brilliant because I look for it now. I want to support my state more than I want to support where North Carolina and Duke are.
It's a big deal to say you're Kentucky Proud. We have 7,000 members now. It's a program that really has just gotten so big and so powerful that a lot of folks are putting it on their advertising for free. They don't get a single tax dollar from us. Like Kroger, they're promoting Kentucky Proud because that's what their consumers want. That's what their consumers want. Customers want. And so that's what that's a measure of success when people are doing it. And not asking for money.
So Cameron and I are both on this kind of paleo diet where we pay really close attention to farm-to-table stuff.
Yep.
And there's a huge growing demand for that. How are you in the ag department? It seems like you're gearing up for that to continue. In other words, gearing up so the state has the infrastructure to keep what we make here in the state.
That's right.
What we grow here in the state.
So, where it's surgically logical to do it.
Right.
And like the beef industry, half of all of our farms have beef cattle. And so that was an area for us to make an impact for a lot of folks. And guess what? It's a small market right now that we actually are operating in. If we can do beef, we can do steaks next. Maybe we can do other animals. And we might be able to disrupt this supply chain that's concentrated in the Midwest, mm-hmm. all based off economy of scale. But if we can do it here in Kentucky, who knows? We might be able to attract a processor here.
So what was the big challenge?
Logistics.
Is that it? Because is it kind of like the same reason the price of oil stays high? We got all this oil sitting around. We got no place to refine it. I mean, is that basically the deal?
That plus the certifications that are needed to sell in a grocery store. Like, okay. They're so stringent, which understandably so. You want to make sure there's a food safety component there. But it took about 18 months to put this deal together. And so it's just like I've kind of been comparing it to watching post-Soviet countries turn into capitalist markets, is that we're kind of sitting there watching the market. We're watching the prices. We'll have sold 50,000 pounds of Kentucky ground beef by mid-June. And so we're wow. very, very happy about this.
What is let's talk about this. Let's get very – I don't know if granular is the right word, but what are – I mean, list Kentucky cash crops now in order of significance.
Sure. Well, number one, we can do it in two categories.
Okay.
Real quickly. On the livestock side, poultry.
Yeah.
Poultry is the number one livestock. A lot of folks don't realize that. We're a big chicken state. Then we have beef cattle. And then it quickly goes to far distance, third, fourth, and fifth when it comes to specialty livestock. You know, sheep are getting big. Goats are getting big.
Alpacas.
And yeah, I went to an alpaca yeah. farm last week. It was awesome.
I've heard.
I'll take you there. Alpaca bag for you.
I don't know that I'd think it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was worse. Did you hear that one on the farm?
I was sitting on that one for a while.
I was going to say, couldn't wait to roll that one out.
It was worse than my milking the pigs
yeah,
joke.
Well,
I
don't even know.
But you know, we traditionally been a big hog state. It's not as big as it used to be. But
okay.
guess what? Any sausage you order in any Cracker Barrel in the United States comes from Kentucky.
Really?
Yeah.
How do they make sausage? What's in that?
Well, first you get a bunch of legislators together and cut the pig up. But as a former legislator, I can say that.
That was actually better.
Oh, it's good.
That
it's
was good.
Good. Now, on your production crop side,
yeah. Yeah.
Corn and soybeans are about $1 billion crop each. We
okay.
are a big grain state. A lot of people don't think about
yeah.
that, but Kentucky is a grain state.
Not bourbon.
Wheat. Oh, yeah. You know, we liquefy 15 million bushels of corn.
I was going to ask how much of it goes to our bourbon.
Yeah, about 6% of the crop.
Because bourbon is one of the largest growing, I guess, alcoholic products in the world right now, or
oh,
has
yeah.
been.
And one thing we try to do at the Department of Ag is we talk with these bourbon distillers every week. And we say, what can we do to get more Kentucky corn into your Kentucky bourbon? And most of them say, find us a farmer. Find us a dealer that knows where to buy Kentucky Proud corn. And we've been able to do that. And the amount of Kentucky corn going into Kentucky bourbon has increased by 65% in just the past
wow.
2 years. And as we have 7 million barrels of bourbon aging right now. Mm-hmm. We're getting close to having 2 barrels of bourbon for each Kentuckian.
Jeez.
That is monumental, and that's where we can
it's
really
not,
help.
It's not a funny way of thinking
let's,
about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, because I was like, this, the way you said it.
Let's not drink it all at
two,
the same time.
2 barrels no. for each of us? All right.
That whole state's just wasted, man. <It's> like,
And just like the craft beer industry, that's an opportunity where the Kentucky Department of Ag, we realize and we see a market that's growing, and we're literally trying to connect them with a Kentucky farmer. Before they just go out in the open market and buy something from God knows where,
mm-hmm.
let them buy local first. And corn into bourbon has been a success. Just like hops, we have a dozen people growing hops for a commercial purpose in Kentucky
wow.
right now. I was able to get a small research grant from the U.S. government to help research hops. We used to be a big hop state before Prohibition put us out of business. Because if you wanted local beer in 1920, guess what? You had to have local ingredients back then.
Yeah.
So we're bringing it back.
How about this? You bring up what Prohibition did in the 20s, right?
Mm-hmm.
In Bourbon County, Kentucky, there is one
yep.
bourbon distillery,
That's
and it's
right.
Hartfield and Company.
That's right.
And Andrew Buchanan, who's a friend of mine. And I just the idea of in Bourbon County, Kentucky, and the reason is Prohibition
yeah.
put them all out of business, and finally he built one. What 3 or 4 years ago,
yeah.
I think he started Hartfield and Company.
That's right, been there, and that's the story. Like now we're
yeah,
starting to see these craft distillers, and they're making an impact, and people want to buy it. It's great.
Again, it goes back to I want to support my state before I support anything else.
Yeah,
I mean I want to help people here because Ryan, it goes back to something you said earlier. I mean, and I can't remember how exactly you put it, but it was because you know basically I'm proud to be a Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And I want us to succeed. The expectation nationally of who we are as Kentuckians
yeah.
and what we are as a state is still so stupidly misinformed.
It is. I think if somebody from California were to meet Ryan Quarles and talk
yeah.
to you,
about what's going on the farm side here, they'd probably be surprised.
They probably would.
Which I want to bring it back to that because there's a couple questions that I had about. I want to talk about the food chain.
Yeah.
Tell me something about how we get the food on our table that would surprise people.
Well, number one,
that we should fix, that you would like to see fixed in the chain of whether it's an animal or vegetable to getting to my table.
The biggest one is the distance. Right now, we have people in Kentucky who want to grow produce, but because of all the rules and regulations, and some of them are good, some of them protect the public safety, prevent farmers from really ramping up a produce operation. For instance, we've been trying for a long time to get Kentucky Proud food into our school cafeterias at lunch.
Right.
It's great food, but because of procurement rules, because of this, that, and the other, which we're actually fixing right now, it's hard for that to happen. And so I've always been a little frustrated with some of our own, mainly federal rules that prevent local food going into our school cafeterias.
So the government gets in the way of me having a farm and making sure tomatoes get to my local school?
Yes, just because of procurement rules, and we're trying to fix that.
I don't understand that.
Yeah,
what does that mean?
There are so many check boxes you have to go through.
Like what? Here's a tomato.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I just want to give you a tomato, Ryan. And the government is Cameron over here, and the government takes the tomato out of my hand and goes, check these boxes. What boxes do I have to check to give you a dang tomato?
Well, if I'm sitting as a school procurement officer, do you have your third-party evaluation forms filled out that show that
Leland? That's not a tomato; that's a rock.
Thanks, government.
Yeah,
I've had two parties. We can obviously throw a third one.
Yeah, just as some sort of independent verification. That's been the biggest one. There's another rule coming out.
Hold on. We need another person to come in and say yes, that's a tomato, before the government can say okay, you can give the tomato to the school.
That's right, and plus, it's mainly a food safety issue.
We have third parties arguing whether it's a tomato.
And the biggest issue is price points.
Okay.
At the end of the day, you know, you're going to buy something that you can afford
right.
with the volume that you need for like a school system. But we are really chipping away from that. And this summer, we're challenging the status quo with Kentucky Proud. Something very similar to the school program is called summer feeding sites. And so a lot of these kids that are on free and reduced lunch in the school system during the spring and fall, guess what? They're still hungry during the summer. And so there's a USDA program that has similar but different rules from the school systems about what food you can buy, and it's a little bit more relaxed. And so this summer we're actually giving these 2,000 summer feeding sites around Kentucky a small incentive to buy local first, to buy Kentucky Proud, because instead of getting on a computer and ordering lettuce or tomatoes from God knows where,
right.
we're encouraging them to go down their farmer's market and say, hey, if you buy from a local farmer, we're going to give you a very small financial incentive just to help you make that introduction with that farmer. And guess what? That might encourage that farmer to go out and say, I'm going to get third-party certified so I can be in a better position to maybe sell to the school system a year or 2 years from now.
What are these third parties?
Well, a lot of them are welcomed by the industry. Like, for instance, if you're growing organic food in Kentucky,
right.
you need to make sure that brand is protected,
okay.
that you're actually doing what the federal definition of organics is. Another one would make sure that your safety issues on the farm are concerned. And this is something that, again, the industry welcomes, but for some of our smaller producers, it may not be worth it.
Mm.
Because there is a cost involved.
You and I have talked about this, too, and it was something you opened my eyes to, Leland, whereas – and you've even said, and I get the frustration, and this is where government should be chipping away at its own regulations.
Right.
But you said, you know, we should know what's in our
Absolutely.
Food, and that's where government should be
yeah.
involved. It's just here's some overreach.
Yeah, it's one of the few areas where I actually agree with government regulation is I have a right to know as a consumer what's in my food,
mm-hmm.
where it came from,
mm-hmm.
and what kind of life it had. You know what I mean? I mean, I have a right to know. Was it shot up with a bunch of hormones? Was it shot up with a bunch of antibiotics that – you know, are getting into our system and our stream now. So, and you can make a decision based on the science or not.
Right.
Does that matter to you or does it not?
You know, it's what the consumer wants.
Right.
You know, some people like to buy organic. Some people don't care about that. Some people care about GMOs. Some people don't
right.
care about that. At the end of the day, I've always been an advocate for, you know, the market's gonna go where the consumer wants. But at the same time, we need to make sure that we educate the consumers about the facts about agriculture. Let me just
right.
tell you just a couple things. There was a survey last year, 2017, that came out. I think it was the Wall Street, the Washington Post, I believe, revealed some startling statistics. And this is where we got to push back a little bit. 16 million Americans think that chocolate milk comes from brown cows and white milk comes from the white cows.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
They don't. No.
40%.
I can't believe that because it will make me want to die.
40.
I don't even want to think.
Here's another one. 40% of American school children don't know that cheese is a dairy product. Or they don't think, they think that hamburger.
Well, half the time.
Well, I was going to say, half the time it's not a dairy product.
Half the time it's pasteurized cheese product or whatever. But yeah, I get it.
So when you have a consumer that doesn't know the difference between a soybean and a green bean, we have to educate.
Right.
We have to educate because right now we have an agriculture farming model in America that's based on high quality, big volume at the cheapest price.
Right.
And guess what? Calories are cheap in America. It's easy to go buy calories.
Yeah,
if you
right.
want nutritious food, which Kentucky farmers are great at producing, sometimes you have to pay a premium for it.
Right.
And guess what? Americans spend less money, less of their disposable income on food than any other country. Mm. That's something that makes me proud. But at the same time, you know, sometimes we need to make sure that we give the consumer the opportunity to connect with alternative food for us.
Well, and I think some of it too is I like it too that we're spending less on food because it's cheaper here. But at the same time, that doesn't mean we can't make it better.
That's right. And we're one of the three bread baskets in the world. There's only three areas that really have the soil, the land mass, and the distribution that the United States has with feeding the world. And that's something we take a lot of pride in. But at the same time, I constantly talk with farmers saying, you know what? Go out and invite the public on your farm. Let them see what you do because there's a lot of misperceptions. People think we're, you know, not pro-environment, but we are.
Right.
Farmers are pro-conservation. We have a farmsman in my family.
Just like hunters. Yeah.
Pro-conservation.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to pass that farm down to the next generation. So it's in my best interest to make sure the soil is healthy, make sure we have good production practices that help the sustainability of that farm.
I wanted a question. We talk about local beef.
Yes.
You know, we always talk about how the limestone underneath our ground makes our horses stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Our bourbon better.
Minerals.
Right. Well,
but yeah, but we actually say that we actually believe that. Does it make our beef better?
I don't know, but let's just say yes.
Okay. Well, there's the politician in him right there.
You were talking about local cows. I had a friend the other day. He called me. He said, I got a couple steaks here from a cow that was on my brother's farm.
Yeah.
You want them? Yeah. A couple of tomahawk ribeyes, right?
Oh.
Yep.
I'll have one.
Oh, yeah. It was honest. I ate them already.
Yeah. Sure.
It was honestly the best beef I've ever put in my mouth.
Yeah.
I swear to God. It was so juicy. It was so tender. And it was so flavorful.
I hate you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. It tasted better. And we tend to buy from local farms, too. And that there's a difference.
There is. It's just like, you know, I've always talked about, you know, when you raise your own tomatoes in your backyard, they're going to taste great. You buy something, a tomato that was designed to sit in a warehouse for a week and ripen while it was after it was taken off the vine. No, there's going to be a difference there.
Yeah.
And local beef has been a big, big boon for Kentucky because in almost every county, you can find a farmer that's raising beef specifically for a group of families or for, you know,
for whatever reason.
Mm. Yeah.
I just love that. I love cow pooling. I just think that's great.
Yeah.
What's coming down the pipe? I mean, we talked hemp. Mm-hmm. What else is out there that you and your office is looking at that, okay, this is beyond hemp. This is something else that we've got to get done in Kentucky agriculturally.
Well, the number one is making sure we educate that consumer. And we touched on that, and we can talk about it later if you want to. But that we have a consumer that we have to remind constantly that food doesn't magically show up at a grocery store. Mm. That, you know, it comes from a family farm, and it's safe, and it's abundant. But there's a lot of technology coming down the pipeline. We're talking about about precision agriculture, where we have technology now that instead of broadcasting, say, a pesticide or weed killer across the entire crop, actually you drive over the crop and a computer identifies which weeds are there. And instead of broadcasting a chemical out, it specifically targets that one little plant.
Wait a minute. Hold on. This is fascinating. Okay, so this would solve the issue of putting lots of pesticides on our foods. In big crops.
It would help reduce that. That's right. But to be clear, the amount of pesticide use in America now because of our technology is down. We were using less. We don't have to have as much. So we're already efficient. But this is the next generation. This is like going from 3G to 4G. Mm.
Is the reason behind that – I like that. That's good.
Yeah.
Is the reason behind that
A, or could it be both of these? Is it one, because it saves on money on the amount of process? It's efficiency. But is it also to avoid putting chemicals on our food as often as possible?
I think it's both, but at the same time, I think it's efficiency. You know, farmers, instead of buying new, we get the duct tape out,
right.
We get the baling twine out, we keep things
That's
going.
What all that work is putting those combines back together in the winter, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
In Kentucky has a history of ag innovation. You know, we're the ones that invented no-till corn, which has saved God knows how many billions of gallons of diesel fuel every year with not having to till the ground as much. It's in Kentucky where we took a tobacco plant, an unlikely plant, turned it into an Ebola-fighting vaccine being used in West Africa to help save lives. Mm. We have this history of innovation, and that's one reason why this next level of technology is going to be huge, because number one, we need to maintain our efficiency. But number two, we have a growing world population. We have 7.3 billion people on this earth right now. By year 2050, we're going to have 9 billion. Here in the United States, by year 2050, 84% of us are expected to live in cities and not in rural America. And so we have got to maintain and build upon our technological advantages in agriculture. I personally, this is the vision that I share with a lot of people in Kentucky, including the late Pierce Lyons from Alltech. There's no ag tech hub in America. There's no one place. It's not like a Silicon Valley. Mm. Why not let Kentucky be that place? Because we have small farms. We're not used to these huge acreage farms you see out in the Midwest where they only focus on three or four crops. Here, you can drive 10 minutes in Kentucky and see a dozen different crops in the field.
Yeah.
We're used to that small farm. We're used to having a very aggressive research environment here, like University of Kentucky, KSU, or regionals. We have a lot of different things going on here. And plus, we've got a company like Alltech that has locations in like 120 countries, something like that, that is used to innovating. Why not make Kentucky the Silicon Valley?
So what's the barrier to that?
Well, number one, we need to let the word out that this is something we're actively pursuing. Number two, we need to create somewhat of an incentive model.
Well, I mean, technology companies aren't just going to come because you said, hey, we'd like you to come here. I mean, what's the barrier between them going, you know what, that Kentucky there?
We need the critical mass. We need the critical mass to get them here. And Alltech would be that anchor because they're used to innovation. But, I mean, imagine a day where a young person, one of these millennials, you know, we've been talking about, says, you know what, I want to combine my computer programming skill with farming.
Nobody – who would put that together naturally?
I mean – oh, there's a lot of nerds out there. I know them.
But I'm just thinking in terms of – just randomly thinking of those are two very different things. Until you spend time on a farm and you see – I remember being in – sadly, it was Indiana. But driving, getting out on a farm, I was there for a ministry trip, and I was being hosted by a huge farm family. And they let me go out and drive a combine, drive one of their tractors with
tank tracks. I really hope they had insurance.
It was Indiana. What difference does it make? I was blown away with – the technology in the equipment.
Oh yeah,
and thinking, and it looks, it's more technological than my car, which I guess it should be in a sense. Mm-hmm. Those combines cost $300,000, but more than that. All right, but unless you go out there and see what you don't think of technology in farming, and I think that's a lot of what you've talked about today. But you just unless you consider it that to me that and the critical mass to me. Thinking not as someone who's heavily involved it's what you said, it's the word of mouth, it's letting the kids know this is a future, it's a vocation,
and you can make money.
Thank you.
And you can make new money.
Yeah.
You know, I spoke to the Kentucky FFA convention a couple weeks ago, and I'll be speaking to the 4-H convention as well. And I always tell them, I was like, there could be an Elon Musk or a Bill Gates of agriculture sitting in this crowd. Do your research here. Let's create an environment where we are known nationally as that place, the go-to place. Use those five universities that have ag programs, anchored with UK College of Ag, as the anchor point. And let's create a lab where people can innovate like this. And farmers have been early adopters. We've been slapping GPS machines on our tractors long before Siri was around. I remember in the mid-90s we were using that. And right now we're moving
from – what are you using them for?
Mainly to map and collect data. We're data hogs. Okay. Farmers are data hogs. Big data. And right now we have satellite technology that can literally analyze the soil conditions the day of application.
Wow.
And we're moving from what are we doing with 10 acres to what are we doing with a square meter. And now we're saying what is the best optimal growing condition for each single seed in a field.
As a farmer, if you could invent one thing that would make farmers' lives easier, what would it be? Like, what would be something you'd like to see come out of a lab?
If I was
like
10
that?
Years old, I would have said a tobacco harvesting machine.
yeah.
But
to pick it, strip it.
I think that because there's a lack of labor in the United States when it comes to agricultural jobs, anything we can do to further mechanize, that'd be the number one thing right now.
That's such a different thing than what you're used to hearing, which is the computers and robots and technology is going to take jobs away.
We actually need
Here's
it.
What
in
we
this
need
industry.
It because we don't have the workforce.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, a farmer, their office is outside, rain or shine, regardless of the temperature, and access to qualified labor that can pass a drug test. You just talked about these combines you're in.
Yeah. I've been in twice now. Don't put me in them all the
time.
Well,
yeah. I mean, we have the same issues other employers have. We don't want to put someone in the seat of that machine that can't pass a drug test. And so that's a big issue for us. It's a huge issue. Mm-hmm. But right now, we need to maintain our competitive advantage. And because other countries are investing, China is investing big time. They're buying land in Africa right now to secure their food sources. One of those other breadbaskets I was talking about is the former Soviet country of Ukraine that now is starting to embrace technology. And when they come online, and when Brazil does not have really good infrastructure right now, but when they improve their roads and waterways, it's going to only put more pressure on the American farmer to do more with less. And so right now is the time to invest.
There's got
to
be – I'm thinking about a TV show I once saw. So this is the level of education I have on the subject. But I'm just thinking about – there's got to be more flat land in the Ukraine than we have in our Midwest.
I couldn't tell you, but
– I mean, just thinking about randomly just a car show I saw one time where they're driving across the Ukraine. And it was nothing but hours and out like days of just flat – like Kansas to Colorado land. Yeah. Oh, no, it was. That was the whole point of that part of the show is how boring it was. But now I'm thinking agriculturally, that's got to be good farmland.
Yeah. I hated driving across Nebraska.
Have you done Kansas?
Oh, yeah.
The first part of course you have. You live in the first part of Kansas is great. Then you get to that part and you see the flat and the wheat and you're like, wow, this is beautiful.
The worst,
and then 5 minutes later, you're like, all right, I'm done.
The worst is Central Texas. Mm. You get out of Dallas. And from there to basically Midland, Odessa, there's nothing.
Yes.
I mean, it's like flat and brown grass. And then finally when you get to Pecos, you can start to see some mountains.
But Nashville to Memphis.
Awful. Yes, awful. At least there's trees.
Yeah.
But it's so flat.
Yeah, but that's all there is.
And there's Jackson. You can stop and get something to eat.
Give me some rolling hills in southeastern Kentucky.
Yeah, no kidding. Arkansas. Oh, yeah. I don't know why God made it.
According to Ross Perot, it's for chicken farms.
They have the worst.
Isn't that
first
what he
said? Yeah, I think so. And first of all, they have the worst roads in America. And when you get into Arkansas, you can smell it.
What?
Yeah, I mean, it's bad.
It might be the Mississippi River.
I don't know why we're talking about road trips here. Have you ever taken a road trip all the way across the country?
Not all the way, but I just drove back from Iowa. And it was some flat country.
Yeah,
coming back. But
not that much out that way either. So, well, it's been great having you in. I guess just leave us with a message of where you'd like to see, you know, I guess ag disrupted as you continue about your terms.
For me, a focus on what the consumers want. And Kentucky could be the best incubator state out there because we're a small farm state. Like you said, you buy your beef from friends and you may go down to the local farmers market. I want to help see that become a bigger part of our economy because that's what the consumer wants, but also break down those barriers, those institutional barriers, like that school lunch program.
Yeah.
Like those summer feeding programs where we can
Didn't you spearhead an effort to make sure that food stamps could be used at farmers markets, which I think is a no-brainer.
Awesome. Yeah.
Now,
because that's the good food.
If you're on government assistance, then we should try to make sure you're eating healthy.
Right. Not getting empty calories, I can't imagine.
I see somebody
with the exception of maybe celery. I can't imagine anything at a farmer's market that's just empty calories.
No, and I've seen this happen before. Somebody will take food stamps into a convenience store, and they'll come out with a bag of chips and a soda, and I'm like, no.
So in a lot of our farmer's markets now, they can take EBD cards.
That's what I meant.
Not food stamps, but EBD cards. But we're doing even better than that because of generous donations from various charities, private donations. A lot of these farmers markets, now you can actually get a coupon which doubles the amount of food you can buy if you are on a social welfare program.
Mm, okay.
And look, just like
I'd rather subsidize that than just about anything else. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not a big fan of subsidies, but I know for those that can't help themselves. But if you're going to subsidize anything, subsidize healthy food.
Yeah.
I mean,
You know,
and that includes having healthy food in our schools at a young age, but not dictating it from the government down. You know, let the consumer.
Because if they're eating at the farmer's market, there's less of a chance that I'm going to be paying for their health care 20 years from now.
That's true. That's true.
I got to worry about my own.
Preventative maintenance right there.
Yeah. So awesome. Well, it's good to have you.
Glad to be here.
Anything else for him, Cameron?
No, absolutely. Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it.
Hey, be sure to buy Kentucky Proud. And hey, if you know a farmer, go out and say thank you. Mm. And, you know, who knows? Maybe one day your child or a relative of yours may choose agriculture as a career. And Kentucky, I'm confident we can be the state, the go-to state for what's new in ag.
Last question. How do we get more farmers?
You have to inspire them to embrace a lifestyle and not an occupation.
So if you like to get up early, talk to Ryan Quarles.
That's right.
All right. That's cool. All right. This is the Disruption Zone. We had Ryan Quarles as our guest today, Kentucky Agriculture Commissioner. That is Cameron Mills. I'm Leland Conway.